From human rights to criminal justice to gun violence and more, Jacksonville activist Wells Todd is in studio and taking your calls this morning. Good Monday morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show's always live at 9, and now subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, a conversation with the Jacksonville Progressive Coalition's Wells Todd. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Also ahead, being proactive about prostate cancer, an important conversation for the man in your life. We'll have a look ahead to this weekend's free symposium in downtown Jacksonville, plus a look at all this weekend's sports with Cole Pepper, all of that and more ahead this hour. But first this morning, still lots of discussion around town about the city's human rights ordinance after last week's big town hall meeting at Edward Waters College. And while headlines around the world are being dominated right now by news of terrorism and the Islamic State, here in our area, a debate over crime and punishment in North Florida is also continuing. With thoughts on all of these issues and more, we welcome Wells Todd of the Jacksonville Progressive Coalition to Studio 5. Wells Todd, thanks for coming back to the show. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa, and thank you for having me.
And we welcome your thoughts and calls on a range of issues this morning. The number to call in is 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. Lots to talk about. Let's begin with your thoughts about last week's town hall meeting at Edward Waters College on the city's human rights ordinance. The Jacksonville Progressive Coalition has spoken out about that.
Yes, Melissa. The coalition, the Jacksonville Coalition for Equality, has been doing fantastic work to make sure that this ordinance is passed. I had questions about why religion was part of the discussion, and the reason I say that is because this is a human rights issue, and there's no reason why the LGBTQ community should not have their rights. It's very simple. All of us, you know, citizens here in Jacksonville, and there's no reason why they should not. There was a lot of talk at that meeting about religion being attacked and what's going to happen to the church if this is passed. Nothing's going to happen to the church if this is passed. The church will continue to be able to decide what they do inside their buildings, inside their churches. So the fear tactics that we use were to me, nonsensical.
A coalition of religious leaders came out last week in support of expanding the ordinance. Your thoughts about that?
Yes, I think that's very good. The last time this HRO came up, they did not have that support. And I think it's very good that they have that support. And a lot of them were at the meeting Thursday night. I had a question about the panel itself. We had all men, no women, nobody from the LGBTQ community. And so that alone, raises questions as to what the thinking is of some of the leaders in this town.
And as we continue to speak with Wells Todd of the Jacksonville Progressive Coalition, we want your thoughts and calls on a number of issues. Give us a call at 549-2937. You've discussed that issue, but the coalition has been more vocal as of late when it comes to criminal justice in North Florida. In fact, you've asked to appear on this program as the race for state attorney in our area heats up. In recent weeks, we've hosted both sitting state attorney Angela Corey and her challenger, Wes White. You, Wells Todd, have been critical in the past of Ms. Corey and requested some time this morning to talk about this campaign. Why so?
Because Ms. Corey has done things that have been detrimental to the African-American community, and I think it's time for her to be removed. We have, in our land now, across the country, these mandatory minimum sentencing guidelines. And when she was on the show, she started out by saying there are facts that we can't talk about because of the crime. And she wanted the people to believe that the justice system is such a complicated beast, she stated, that it would be hard for people to understand. Well, I think the people of Jacksonville are intelligent enough to understand the law when it's explained to them. And I think that that was very condescending to the public. It's not a complicated beast when children are being, you know, put in facilities for nonviolent offenses. I think that what happens is she has all the power. And we have a number of circuits in Florida. And each circuit and each prosecutor basically can run their office the way they want to. So as far as her being, you know, bound by certain rigid laws, that's not the case. And I want to point out something. She made it sound like the judge has a decision, makes a decision whether or not a child is put in adult court. And that is absolutely not true. Ms. Corey has the final say in whether or not a child is tried as an adult. What the judge does after the child is found guilty is he can make recommendations that either reflect juvenile or adult punishment. So she has the final say in that.
And the number to join us, 549-2937. Recently, State Attorney Angela Corey published an op-ed in the Florida Times-Union with the intent, in her words, to clear up what she says are myths surrounding her leadership of the office. Let me quote from this op-ed. Myth: the state attorney's office leads the state and country in sending juveniles to adult court. Fact: we are ninth in the state out of 20 circuits. Of the approximately 3,000 juvenile cases opened in fiscal year 2013-14, 75 were moved to adult court. These were serious and violent cases such as murder and armed robbery and the like. What you may not realize is that in other states like New York, 16 and 17-year-olds automatically go to adult court for misdemeanors and felonies. She goes on to say that it's a myth that her office charges every juvenile who commits a crime, that in fact they divert hundreds of juveniles each year into services such as drug treatment, counseling, anger management, and more. Basically, her letter goes on to say that agenda-driven individuals are misrepresenting what's going on in her office. It's a response, it seems, to a letter that you published in the Florida Times-Union criticizing the way she runs the office. What about the statements in her op-ed?
Well, you know, from 2009 to 2013, Corey's office incarcerated over 1,000 juveniles, placing them in a Duval Regional Juvenile Detention Center. This facility is notorious for overcrowded, overcrowding and for kids getting into fights, and for kids staying longer than they should stay in this facility. And part of that has to do with, and I'm going to move a little bit away from that, because part of that has to do with what I'm calling an intimidation process. The longer you keep a kid incarcerated, the longer the family has to go through their child being incarcerated, being out of school, being out of the home, the more likely the family will take a plea. And this is happening across the country. We had a case right here where a gentleman was in locked up for I don't know how many days and then let go. So that's a problem. And Jacksonville does lead the state. I question the rebuttal she has for facts. And some of what I put in my letter to the Times Union were investigative facts that their reporters reported on. So my question is, And I have a question for Ms. Corey. Why are people out to get her? Why are people, you know, telling lies about her? And I don't believe that that's the case. I believe that these are true things that are happening. And I believe that the community at large needs to stand up and point out that they won't stand for this anymore.
We need your calls this morning as we speak with Wells Todd of the Jacksonville Progressive Coalition at 549-2937. We have hosted both Angela Corey and her challenger in the state attorney's race, Wes White, and we'll continue to book both of these guests in the coming months. The election isn't for another year, of course. Let me ask you as a follow-up about Eureka Garden. That is the West Side apartment complex, the Section 8 complex, that's been the subject of much consternation in our city in recent months. People there, folks there living in deplorable conditions, Mayor Lenny Curry expressing outrage and calling on the owner of the complex to fix the problems there. As of yet, those problems still have not been completely fixed. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, the problems at Eureka Garden, they're major problems. And the owner of Eureka Gardens also owns other housing projects like that throughout the South. He's based in, I believe, Tennessee. I think Eureka Gardens, you know, is systematic of the overall degradation that exists in our society and that exists right here in Jacksonville. And it goes hand in hand with the policing of the African-American community, the absolute lack of jobs in the Black community. We have always had double-digit unemployment of African-Americans in this country, always. And you know, people should really think about that. So Eureka Gardens basically is a place where people can actually get rich off of poor people. You know, they get these grants, they get the money from HUD, and nothing is done for the people. So you have people in Eureka Gardens who are sick. You have children who have asthma. I spoke to some people from there, and they were telling me that they're sewer backs up, you know, into this sink. The plaster's falling down. A gentleman said, you know, he said when he tries to take a shower, there's a hole above him, and the water comes down from the apartment above. So, you know, we're living at a time where you have 1% of the population controlling the wealth, and people getting rich off of the poor.
That Section 8 housing, folks living in Eureka Garden really don't have any other options in terms of affordable housing. But that actually sort of brings up a larger issue, Wells. When it comes to affordable rental housing, Jacksonville and Florida recently have sort of come under the microscope in terms of the fact that if you are looking for an affordable rental unit in this city, they can be very hard to come by. Is that something the coalition is active in trying to address?
We're active in assisting the residents. We're active in helping in any way that we can, like coming on this program and exposing this once again. And I think it's going to take a movement to make anything happen. In Jacksonville, in Florida, in the United States, I think we need a mass movement to change what's been happening in this country. When we look at Angela Corey, if you look at what she's been doing, it's really no different than a lot of prosecutors across the country since they have this power. But we live here in Jacksonville. And our aim is to remove Angela Corey from office.
And let me just jump in. It's 549-2937 to join us. What would you say? Angela Corey campaigned on a Get Tough on Crime platform. The polling showed that was popular with the public. The polling continues to show that the majority of the public approves of that approach. Her polling numbers have dropped somewhat, but still the majority of the voters out there say that that is the approach they want from the prosecutor's office. What would you say to those voters?
I say that Get Tough on Crime has been around since the Nixon administration. and really, for African Americans, Get Tough on Crime means, get tough on blacks, basically, is what it means. And we have to come to grips with the fact that a lot of scare tactics are used to basically be able to make more arrests in the African American community. And we need to look closely at how these laws affect minorities in America. Last year, nearly 600 youth were arrested in Duval County for nonviolent crimes, like stealing socks and spray and stuff from, say, Walmart. And a number of them, you know, were sent away. They were in facilities. And she mentioned Kristen Fernandez and how long she took before she decided to try him as an adult. Well, I'd like to know what the process was. I'd like to know if the defense attorney was involved with the length of time it took for her to try him as an adult. And she still made the mistake at the end, in my opinion. Kristen Fernandez was a child who was abused, neglected. His mother also went through those things, and he's a product of a rape. She was raped and became pregnant with Kristen. And so when you try, you know, a child who's developing, who has no sense of the finality of death, all right, and then you put them in a facility, and then you deny them what you said you were going to give them, which was counseling. And it took making this public, bringing it to the public's eye that he was not receiving the treatment he needed.
And for the record, she does dispute that narrative of events, just to give her office's side of things. But go ahead.
Yeah. And I think the final step here in this process is where these kids end up. They basically end up in private contracted facilities. And we know whenever something goes private, the bottom line is profits. And what's happening is a lot of our kids are going off to jail, okay, who not necessarily need to go to jail to fill up beds. And I would question the morality of that.
Let's go now to Tom on the West Side. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Yes, good morning to you, too. My question is this. Why do we need a human rights ordinance that names every single group? Why can't we not just have an ordinance that says discrimination is wrong and we should recognize the value of every human being as they are without every single possible conceivable group?
Thanks for the call, Tom.
Good question. Good question. There are laws on the books to protect people, but there are no laws on the books to protect the LGBTQ community. And there are cases right here in Jacksonville where people have been fired for being gay, lesbian, transgendered, and they have, there's a saying now that's going around, you get married on Sunday, you get fired on Monday. That, along with being rejected for housing, there's a lot going on regarding the religious community. So those people need protections. I'd like to say this. People are saying that they already have protections and that the things that are happening, the discrimination is not a lot of discrimination. Any discrimination is a lot of discrimination. And the thing is, since there is not an ordinance, there's nobody to report to about a crime. It'd be like me reporting a crime in 1950 about segregation and, you know, being taken, you know, advantage of. There was a great possibility back then that I could be lynched because there was no human rights law.
And here's a tweet about that from Kelly. Does Wells know if his coalition is still advocating for the inclusion of nonviolent offenders and veterans in the JAX HRO?
We think that that is also something that should be looked at. But the Jacksonville Coalition for Equality have an HRO that includes lesbians, gays, bisexuals, and transgendered community. And a lot of those two other things are things that have to be dealt with at a state level because they are legislative.
And Mario is in Arlington. Hey, Mario. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. I was calling to ask Mr. Wells what he and his group are planning on doing to help promote civil citations and if that's something that Angela Corey isn't ready to do, how are we going to get people to the polls to express their concerns about how they're being treated in the community? And I'll take my comment off the air.
Yes, ICARE is working diligently regarding civil citations. I think it's going to take the action and the unity of the community because there are a lot of different groups working around Jacksonville and throughout the state fighting for this.
And by civil citations, he means encouraging the use of more civil citations for juvenile nonviolent offenders as opposed to charging the juvenile. Correct?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
And I thought it was very interesting, the contradiction that Ms. Corey made when she was on the show. She said she's for civil citations, which she's not, or we wouldn't, ICARE and other groups wouldn't be on, this movement to have this done. And she also said she's for the victim. And she said that she was for the victim because of a battery. When the victim gets hit, well, you know, if two kids are fighting in school, somebody's going to get hit, you know? So what does she really mean by that?
What would you say to advocates for Angela Corey, such as Beverly McLean, the founder of the nonprofit Families of Slain Children, primarily ministering to families, primarily African-American families who've lost their kids to gun violence? When women like Beverly say that Angela Corey truly is motivated by a passion to help victims of violent crime, and they really do push back against the narrative that that Angela Corey is prosecuting based on race and those types of criticisms.
Well, I'm really, what's going on in the community is horrendous. Children being killed, old folks being killed. I think that we need to step back and actually look at how much Angela Corey cares. If we look at Marissa Alexander, who was a victim of domestic violence, who was sent first to jail for 20 years for firing a warning shot, and then when she got out, Angela Corey wanted to try her again and wanted to send her away for 60 years. So my question is, if she's for the victim, who is going to take care of Marissa's children? Who's going to take care of the kids that are left behind? Can you imagine your mother being in jail for 60 years? You don't know her. But the person who put her there, cared about the victim. The victim was somebody who beat on women. And it seems to me that Angela Corey really doesn't understand this cycle of abuse and domestic violence, because this happened in another case where she tried a mother and locked her up. So I think that the epidemic of shootings that are happening in Chicago and in other places, and here in Jacksonville, is systemic, and there is a answer for that, for what's happening. We are living in a culture of poverty and a culture that is basically saying, you don't count, and we're not going to help you. Jobs. That's what I'm saying we need to create. And not jobs that, a person brings home $7.50 an hour. We're talking about jobs that are going to lift people out of poverty. When you're in poverty, you know, a lot of things happen. The industry that's been created in the Black community is drugs. It's drugs. And that is something that, you know, won't be stopped unless the community organizes and starts to deal with these larger problems that we face.
We always appreciate your time, and thanks for being with us. We'll continue to host both Angela Corey and Challenger Wes White in the coming months as we follow this campaign. Meanwhile, much more still ahead on this show. Later, Cole Pepper on the Jaguars' loss and the rest of the weekend sports. But up next, we're going to tell you about an important and free public health event coming up, this one for the man in your life.
Hi, I'm Rick Mullaney, director of the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University. Join me for WJCT's quarterly program, Policy Matters. On each installment, we look at how public policy affects our lives. Join the conversation as we speak with Jacksonville Sheriff Mike Williams about public safety issues in Duval County. That's on the next Policy Matters, Wednesday morning at 9 on 89.9 WJCT.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Cattle ranchers today are just about as likely to have business degrees as they are boots and belt buckles.
If you were to ask me 10 years ago, a city girl like me, bottle feeding baby calves, I would have told you were crazy.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, cattle rustling in the 21st century, next time on Marketplace from APN.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Welcome back. Well, there is a great deal of controversy surrounding the screening and treatment of prostate cancer, such a common ailment for so many American men. With that in mind, Jacksonville's inaugural Prostate Cancer Symposium is coming up this weekend at the Downtown Hyatt. Now, this is a free event with lots to learn and share. Kazarian Urology and ZeroCancer.org have partnered to offer this unique opportunity to the community for the man in your life. Dr. Ali Kazarian joins us now with a preview. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And, you know, the old saying I've always heard is that men typically go to their grave with prostate cancer. As men age, the chances are they're probably going to get it, right?
Absolutely. You know, one in seven men will get prostate cancer in their lifetime. And, you know, they've done studies if a gentleman survives till 100 and we just happen to look at their prostate, they may have a prostate cancer that may or may not impact their lives. It's just catching the guys that it may impact.
So with that in mind, you've partnered with ZeroCancer.org to bring about the inaugural Prostate Cancer Symposium coming up at the Hyatt Riverfront this weekend, a free event. This is so important because there's a lot of new data, new studies to share, some controversy as well.
I'll tell you, the controversy here is, as someone who deals with prostate cancer a lot, it's interesting to see where we were with prostate cancer and where we're going. you know, I have the blessing every day to work with my dad. And so my dad's been doing this for about 40 years now. And when my dad was a little bit younger than me, people showed up with prostate cancer when they had spine fractures. Then we developed a PSA, a very, very innovative a screening test with a blood test in the early 90s that over the course of the past few decades decreased the death from prostate cancer by better than 40%. That translated into what they call a quote-unquote overdiagnosis and over-treatment of prostate cancer. So we caught a lot of low-risk, low-volume prostate cancers that were aggressively treated with side effects that brought about a lot of these controversies. So in 2012, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommended against PSA screening that brought about a lot of controversies. And a lot of recent studies have found that we have found significant decreases in screening that have translated into a significant decrease in the detection of prostate cancer that we're now noticing may translate into not that we're not, these cancers are going away, we're just not catching them.
So it's your goal then to make men start thinking about prostate cancer the way women think about mammograms and breast cancer.
Absolutely. You know, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has on multiple occasions recommended against breast cancer screening in women in their 40s. And you see what happens. The women get angry. Different organizations start marching in Washington, and this doesn't see the light of day. For men, you never hear about anything. And even in the awareness campaign, the NFL turns pink in October. The world turns pink. Everyone's running. September was Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. You didn't really hear much in comparison to breasts. November was Movember. You know, I grew a spectacular mustache. People wondered if I'd lost my mind. But
Movember is probably the first thing that's really started to get traction to raise awareness about
it. Because
this.
It's cool and stylish, but yeah. But it prompts a conversation. And that's really what we're hoping to do on Saturday is we've been very blessed to bring some of my mentors through my life as a urologist and a relatively young urologist that are world-renowned experts that have agreed to come to Jacksonville and discuss and try to demystify some of the controversies for prostate cancer. And we're hoping to gear this to men in the community here in Jacksonville, the people that love them, and their primary care physicians. So we want to get the people that the controversies really affect in the room to try to talk about the reasons we think screening for prostate cancer is important, and also try to talk about the idea of personalized prostate cancer care.
What age is the baseline for which men should go and be screened?
And that's a key question. If you look at the different guidelines, they're all over the place, and that's where a lot of the controversies exist, and even for primary care physicians. And that's where the patients and the gentlemen out there need to talk to their physicians. And here's one scary thing before answering this question. The CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, is putting out surveys and considering not paying for PSA and prostate cancer screening. And not only that, they're looking at potentially penalizing physicians who screen for PSA. So if a certain physician screens a too high of a proportion of their population, of their patients, for prostate cancer, they're going to be negatively reimbursed. So here's the study I recommend patients look at when they're looking at screening. A study was done out of Sweden, look at a large number of men over their lifetime, and that first PSA in their 40s was the most predictive of your prostate cancer risk. So if someone in the early 40s, in the 45 age range, if your PSA is less than one, your statistical risk of getting prostate cancer is very, very small. If it's above one, your risk goes a bit higher. And two patient populations are really important. African Americans and people with family history of prostate cancer have a significantly increased risk of prostate cancer. So get that first PSA at 45, and based on that, you can make decisions on what to do next.
Good baseline. Now, you're going to sweeten the deal for the guys.
Absolutely.
Guys are notorious for not wanting to maybe be proactive about their health. So
we're lazy.
You're going to be raffling off some Jags tickets for the Colts-Jags game, a full game package for the Armada, a foursome round of golf at Queens Harbor, raffling off a three-month Bailey's membership, free lunch provided. There's a lot that you're bringing into this event.
We're really trying to get guys motivated to come and talk to this. It's completely free. We're trying to give things away. These are world-renowned experts. It'll be a full-served lunch. So it should be a very, very nice event, and it should be fun. We're going to try to make it fun. It's not going to be a didactic lecture type sitting. It'll be interactive, so you can ask questions, and you'll bring your questions. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. You can get me at Ali Kess Ryan. You can go to the Facebook pages for our practice at Kess Ryan Urology, my personal Facebook at Ali Kess Ryan, and we will respond to everything and ask questions, because our goal is to answer your questions.
It's coming up Saturday, the inaugural Prostate Cancer Symposium, brought to you by Kess Ryan Urology and ZeroCancer.org. This is Saturday, December 12th from 9 to 1 at the Hyatt Riverfront, a free event. So register now. Seating is limited. Go to prostatecancerduval.eventbrite.com. He is Dr. Ali Kess Ryan. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And still to come, sports with Cole, plus why more women on the First Coast are hitting those bike trails around town, and how you can join their new club. That's next.
Novelist Rick Moody and his wife were having an unpleasant stay at a hotel.
And at some point, Laurel, my wife, said, "We should review this hotel."
That became the inspiration for his new book, Hotels of America, told in short online reviews by a man who's proud to be one of the top reviewers on RateYourLodging.com. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
After leaving the military, some vets get in trouble and land behind bars. Some prisons now house them in cell blocks organized like military units.
We want to recapture that positive stuff that they learned in the military and then have them apply it to civilian life.
A program to keep vets from becoming repeat offenders. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekday afternoons from 4 to 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, Jacksonville may be known as one of the least bike and pedestrian-friendly cities in the country, but that's not stopping cyclists from getting out and doing their thing. The Delafina Racing Team is a women's cycling team in Northeast Florida, and they've launched a cycling club for women to empower more female cyclists to get out on their bikes, the Delafina Women's Cycling Club. They want you to come share the road with them. Founding member Sharon Smith and sponsor Scott Gross of the Open Road Bicycles they're both here in studio now to tell us all about it. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
All right. So tell us all about this, Sharon. A cycling club just for women. Pretty exciting.
Yes, it is. The racing team was actually launched back in 2012, and we've been very successful. But we found a lot of women who were really on the bikes or wanting to be on the bikes who weren't interested in racing. And we thought we would provide a whole new presence for women on bikes in our community. So we hope to be this hub for communication, camaraderie, the social network, and just fun together.
So you don't have to be an expert cyclist. You just want to get out. You just have to enjoy riding your bike.
Exactly. Exactly. It's social. We have so much fun. We actually will control the rides so that there's a slower group and a faster group.
Where do you normally go riding?
So we're going to do them all over town. We've had two of them already at the beach. We plan to be in town, Nocatee, down in Fleming Island. We plan to host these rides monthly from different locations so people don't always have to drive to one place.
Now, Scott, Jacksonville's known as one of the least pedestrian and bike-friendly cities in America. You're with Open Road Bicycles. How do you get around that perception when you're encouraging people to get out on their bikes and get into cycling?
I think definitely awareness, both on the cyclists and drivers' viewpoints, so that they understand that it is possible to share the road and make it safe for each other. It doesn't benefit anybody if there's an altercation. So I think it's just really, public awareness, maybe starting at the Division of Motor Vehicles through driver education.
And how important is that piece, driver education?
You know, I definitely see Jacksonville has seen that there's an issue here, and certainly through the Bicycle Pedestrian Awareness Council that's now in Jacksonville, the bike ped coordinator, they're addressing that attitude and getting the signage to, you know, definitely make sure that drivers as well as cyclists are aware of where they're supposed to be on the road and what rules they're supposed to be following. So there's definitely a big input to that.
How many women are in the new Women's Cycling Club so far?
So we're still building it. It's a grassroots organization. The actual launch will be in January.
Oh, it's very nice. How much interest have you had so far?
Quite a bit. We've had earlier rides in the year. We're pulling 40 to 50 women at a time.
And are you planning to go mainly in state parks, along the beach? Will you vary the route, urban, rural?
We will vary the route. We are mostly on the road because women mostly have the road bikes. We do allow them to bring their triathlon bike if they'd like or their beach cruisers.
Can they bring their kids?
Yes, absolutely. We actually have some young girls who have shown up on some of the rides.
That's exciting.
Yeah, and we take care of them.
And this is, I would think, exciting as well, because often when you see a group of cyclists out there, it's almost always a group of men. So
yes,
you're trying to share the road for women.
Yes. And along with that, a lot of the women don't really know how to ride. And so we're going to have some clinics. We'll have some turning clinics, some ride clinics, some technique clinics from some of the pros in the area. So that'll help them learn more, be more comfortable.
Just kind of get the rules of the road when they're out there cycling.
Yes, all for safety.
Quick call on this. It's Harold in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Harold. Go ahead.
Hi, I have a question. I used to live in the Mandarin area, and the group there, the Open Road Bicyclers, their bicycle club would take weekly rides or biweekly rides, and it was a very large group, and they rode in mass, and I observed them with a regularity blaring through stop signs as a group, three-way stop signs where multiple vehicles were waiting. And I wondered if they, you know, he spoke recently about getting bicyclists to obey the rules of the road as well as motor vehicles. I have no problem giving wide berth to a bicycler when they're on the road, but I expect them to follow the same rules that a car is following. And this was an open road bicycle event. And my understanding is if you've got an event of riders and they expect to go through lights like that, they should have a motorcycle escort. Are you planning in the future to have more formal and legal rides, or are you going to continue to operate in the rebel manner rides?
Thanks for the call. Sharon.
Well, that's an interesting topic. I know it has been an ongoing debate. The rules of the road actually allow cyclists to be two by two if they're not impeding traffic. That actual ride actually had some signs posted where the cyclists were allowed to take up the whole road. We actually have some signs like that at the beach. And there's a whole movement. I think Scott's on a board with a local attorney. There is a board and a group that's working on that.
Scott.
Absolutely. First and foremost, the cyclists have to obey by the rules as well as the motorists. And there has been, because of the rides in clearly an urban setting, there has to be, you know, some sharing of the roads. But yes, to no end, the cyclists as well as the drivers have to obey all the signage. And there are, you know, new signs being posted consistently with Share the Road, which does allow the cyclists to take up that lane. And you know, again, to combat this, there's also been some rules where 3 feet have to be given to the cyclists. So there's definitely an ongoing change in the perception of cycling and driving and sharing the roads, and it hasn't come to any end yet. But the first and foremost, yes, cyclists do need to follow and obey all the rules of the road.
But as more cyclists get out on the road, I think drivers as well need to be more aware that they're there.
Yes.
Since obviously if you're in a car, you're driving what can be a deadly weapon, and just be aware that you might see someone
yes,
on a bike out there. And so people need to go to Delafina Women's Cycling Club on Facebook.
Yes.
Or go to DelafinaRacing.com because this club launches next month.
Yes.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
She's founding member Sharon Smith and sponsor Scott Gross of Open Road Bicycles. Sports with Cole in a moment.
Hi, this is Michael Feldman, and thanks to WJCT and the Florida Theater, What Do You Know, Y'all? Is coming to Jacksonville on Saturday, February 20th. We're flying down to check out all 22 miles of beach, maybe do us some fish camping. Join us, won't you? Tickets are available at the Florida Theater box office, by phone at 904-355-2787, or online at floridatheater.com. We'll see you there.
Jewish people called conversos are believed to have practiced their religion secretly in Spanish colonial Florida. It wasn't until 1763 that Judaism was legal here. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll visit the Jewish Museum of Florida in Miami Beach. We'll discuss the papers of Civil War-era Governor John Milton and the turpentine industry. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Well, finally, this hour, the Jaguars score 39 points, but still manage to lose.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Well, Pepper here now with a look at the Jags' loss in Nashville against the Titans. Oh, my goodness.
42-39. Don't often see teams in the NFL scoring 39 points and not winning.
I know.
And it just doesn't happen. Jaguars have some really positive things to point to. Blake Bortles' performance. He became the Jaguars' single season and single game touchdown passer, as he threw for 5 touchdowns and surpassed David Garrard's record from 2007 in the process. Allen Robinson had a big day, 3 touchdowns, and went over 1,000 yards. The first Jaguars receiver to have 1,000 yards receiving since 2005, when a fellow by the name of Jimmy Smith turned the trick. He is now, I think you can actually make the case, we were having a Twitter conversation after the game and during the game yesterday, that I think you might be able to make the case that Allen Robinson might now be the third best receiver in Jaguars history, and he's only in his second year in the league. So that is certainly something that they can build on. Jason Myers going the other way. The kicker missed 2 extra points, and in a year where they've moved the extra point back from snapping it from the 3 to snapping it from the 10, you've seen more missed extra points this year, but nobody has missed as many as Myers 6. And I suspect there may be something done about that in the very near future. The Jaguars are now 4-8, which means that they won't have a winning record. They haven't, by the way, since 2007. And they are getting better. They're better than they were last year. They're in more games. They've been in almost every game this year. There are still deficiencies on the team. But the thing that really troubles me the most here, Melissa, is that when Bortles plays well, they tend to lose. And when he doesn't play as well, they tend to win. And I don't understand that at all. It's counterintuitive.
That is strange.
And you would hope there isn't something deeper to that rather than just happenstance.
But their playoff hopes in the rearview mirror as they're now home against Indianapolis.
Yeah, that'll be the next one on Sunday, next to last home game of the year. 4 games remaining for the Jaguars. They actually are still in the playoff chase because Indy lost last night.
They're
6-6. Yeah. So the Jaguars, if they win out, could potentially be in the playoffs. And even they might not even have to win out. And that's how bad the AFC South is this year, along with the NFC East, the 2 worst divisions in pro football.
Let's move on to college sports. Florida losing in the SEC title game to Alabama.
Yeah, and now Florida heads to the Citrus Bowl to take on Michigan. That's going to be an interesting matchup. Florida having lost badly to Alabama and before that Florida State. So a third straight matchup against a team with some pretty good momentum, Jim Harbaugh's club. Taxpayer Bowl here in town. Everybody in Jacksonville will be calling it the Gator Bowl, sorry.
Yeah.
And Georgia returning to take on Penn State. I think this is an interesting choice. You know, there are kind of 3 reasons, 3 main criteria that the Gator Bowl Association and the Taxpayer Bowl Committee uses to select the teams that will come. Number one is it an attractive TV matchup? Number 2 is, will it bring fans and people traveling into Jacksonville? And 3, how easy will it be to sell tickets locally and regionally to fans who aren't necessarily fans directly of those teams or who wouldn't necessarily travel in? It's interesting with Georgia because you have a lot of Georgia fans in Jacksonville, of course. You have a lot within a day's drive of Jacksonville. So I don't think this is going to have the economic impact that you would have if you had a team from elsewhere. Plus, you have a lot of folks who come down to Jacksonville who are Georgia fans for Florida, Georgia, and this will be a very different kind of experience for them. Will they have the same kind of trip in? Penn State, though, is a great pick. a huge alumni base. They'll sell a lot of tickets there. I think they'll travel well because Penn State's coming through this mess with Joe Paterno and so forth over the last several years. I think that this will be you'll see a lot of Nittany Lions fans in Jacksonville in and around New Year's.
What are your thoughts about Florida State versus Houston in the Peach Bowl?
So that's not necessarily on its face, a traditional matchup. You wouldn't know Florida State, Houston, that doesn't do much. But Houston was terrific this year, lost just one game. They score a lot of points. They're high-powered. I think this is going to be a very attractive game from a football standpoint. And that'll be in Atlanta, so you'll have plenty of Florida State fans who will be able to travel up there. Meanwhile, Miami against Washington State in the Sun Bowl, if you're a Hurricanes fan, don't think that's one of the more attractive bowl games going. But the college football playoffs now will certainly be dominating the conversation from here on out. The Orange Bowl will have number one seed Clemson against the 4 seed Oklahoma. The Cotton Bowl will have Alabama against Michigan State. I think Alabama will win that one. I'm still back and forth on my Clemson versus Oklahoma pick, and I've got about 3 weeks before I have to actually make a pick, so I'm going to hold off on that one. But I like the way Alabama's playing right now quite a bit.
And you want to talk about the Heisman Trophy stakes as well.
Speaking of Alabama, Derrick Henry, the front runner, the Yulee High School product, an Alabama running back, fell just shy of getting to 2,000 yards through the course of the regular season. He will certainly do that in the postseason with one or two more games to play. And there's nobody else who's really challenging him at this point. There are other guys, regionally may get some interest, but I think Derrick Henry will be your Heisman Trophy winner when they hand that out in New York. And if we have a moment, Melissa, I would like to mention two area teams won state titles in the high school football ranks over the weekend. University Christian and Trinity Christian both won.
Yay!
So congratulations to those two schools who have had great success. Three straight for Trinity Christian, which is a rarity in high school football. And for Rains, they came oh so close. Aww. They had a fourth quarter lead and then wound up giving it away. A couple of turnovers turned into touchdowns for Booker T. Washington out of Miami, who has now amazingly won four straight state championships.
Man.
That ties a state record.
Oh, so close. Well, kudos to all the kids out there, though, that they played so hard all through the season. And thank you, Cole Pepper, as always.
Thanks, Melissa.
Follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Next on Diane Rehm, the FBI calls the San Bernardino shooting an act of terrorism. Diane and guests discuss the latest on the investigation, as well as fears that mass shootings are the new normal in America. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.